Chapter 15. Clear of the locksmith's house, Sim Tapper that laid aside his cautious manner, and assuming in its stead that of a ruffling, swaggering, roving blade, who would rather kill a man than otherwise, and eat him too if needful, made the best of his way along the darkened streets. Half pausing for an instant now, and then to smite his pocket, and assure himself of the safety of his master key, he hurried on to Barbican, and turning into one of the narrowest of the narrow streets which diverged from that center, slackened his pace, and wiped his heated brow, as if the termination of his walk were near at hand. It was not a very choice spot for midnight expeditions, being in truth one of more than questionable character, and of an appearance by no means inviting. From the main street he had entered, itself little better than an alley, a low-browed doorway led into a blind court, or yard, profoundly dark, unpaved, and reeking with stagnant odors. Into this ill-favored pit, the locksmith's vagrant prentice groped his way, and stopping at a house from whose defaced and rotten front the rude effigy of a bottle swung to and fro like some gibbeted malefactor, struck thrice upon an iron grating with his foot. After listening in vain for some response to his signal, Mr. Tapper that became impatient, and struck the grating thrice again. A further delay ensued, but it was not of long duration. The ground seemed to open at his feet, and a ragged head appeared. "Is that the captain?" ... said a voice as ragged as the head. "Yes, ... replied Mr. Tapper that haughtily, descending as he spoke, "who should it be?" ... "It's so late, we gave you up, ... returned the voice, as its owner stopped to shut and fasten the grating. "You're late, sir." ... "Lead on, ... said Mr. Tapper that, with a gloomy majesty, "and make remarks when I require you. Forward." ... This latter word of command was perhaps somewhat theatrical and unnecessary, inasmuch as the descent was by a very narrow, steep, and slippery flight of steps, and any rashness or departure from the beaten track must have ended in a yawning water butt. But Mr. Tapper that being, like some other great commanders, favorable to strong effects and personal display, cried forward. ... again, in the hoarsest voice he could assume, and led the way, with folded arms and knitted brows, to the cellar down below, where there was a small copper fixed in one corner, a chair or two, a form and table, a glimmering fire, and a truckle bed, covered with a ragged patchwork rug. "Welcome, noble captain." ... cried a lanky figure, rising as from a nap. The captain nodded. Then, throwing off his outer coat, he stood composed in all his dignity, and eyed his follower over. "What news tonight?" ... he asked, when he had looked into his very soul. "Nothing particular, ... replied the other, stretching himself, and he was so long already, that it was quite alarming, to see him do it. "How come you to be so late?" ... "No matter, ... was all the captain deigned to say in answer. "Is the room prepared?" ... "It is, ... replied the follower. "The comrade, is he here?" ... "Yes." "And a sprinkling of the others, you hear 'em?" "Playing skittles." ... said the captain moodily. "Light-hearted revelers." ... There was no doubt respecting the particular amusement in which these heedless spirits were indulging, for even in the close and stifling atmosphere of the vault, the noise sounded like distant thunder. It certainly appeared, at first sight, a singular spot to choose, for that or any other purpose of relaxation, if the other cellars answered to the one in which this brief colloquy took place. For the floors were of sodden earth, the walls and roof of damp bare brick tapestried with the tracks of snails and slugs. The air was sickening, tainted, and offensive. It seemed, from one strong flavor which was uppermost among the various odors of the place, that it had, at no very distant period, been used as a storehouse for cheeses, a circumstance which, while it accounted for the greasy moisture that hung about it, was agreeably suggestive of rats. It was naturally damp besides, and little trees of fungus sprung from every mouldering corner. The proprietor of this charming retreat, and owner of the ragged head before mentioned, for he wore an old tie wig as bare and frowsy as a stunted hearth broom, had by this time joined them, and stood a little apart, rubbing his hands, wagging his hoary bristled chin, and smiling in silence. His eyes were closed, but had they been wide open, it would have been easy to tell, from the attentive expression of the face he turned towards them, pale and unwholesome as might be expected in one of his underground existence, and from a certain anxious raising and quivering of the lids, that he was blind. Even Stagg hath been asleep, apostrophe said the long comrade, nodding towards this person. Sound, Captain, sound. Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried the blind man. What does my noble captain drink? Is it brandy, rum, usquebaugh? Is it soaked gunpowder, or blazing oil? Give it a name, heart of oak, and we'd get it for you, if it was wine from a bishop's cellar, or melted gold from King George's mint. Apostrophe, see, apostrophe, said Mr. Tappertit haughtily, that it's something strong, and comes quick. And so long as you take care of that, you may bring it from the devil's cellar, if you like. Apostrophe, boldly said, noble captain. Apostrophe, apostrophe, rejoined the blind man. Spoken like the prentice's glory. Ha, ha. From the devil's cellar. A brave joke. The captain joketh. Ha, ha, ha. Apostrophe, I'll tell you what, my fine feller, apostrophe, said Mr. Tappertit, eyeing the host over as he walked to a closet, and took out a bottle and glass as carelessly as if he had been in full possession of his sight, if you make that row, you'll find that the captain's very far from joking, and so I tell you, apostrophe, he's got his eyes on me. Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried Stagg, stopping short on his way back, and affecting to screen his face with the bottle. I feel 'em, though I can't see 'em. Take 'em off, noble captain. Remove 'em, for they pierce like gimlets. Apostrophe, Mr. Tappertit smiled grimly at his comrade, and twisting out one more look, a kind of ocular screw under the influence, of which the blind man feigned to undergo great anguish and torture, bade him, in a softened tone, approach, and hold his peace. I obey you, Captain, apostrophe, cried Stagg, drawing close to him, and filling out a bumper without spilling a drop, by reason that he held his little finger at the brim of the glass, and stopped at the instant the liquor touched it. Drink, noble governor. Death to all masters, life to all prentices, and love to all fair damsels. Drink, brave general, and warm your gallant heart. Apostrophe, apostrophe, Mr. Tappertit condescended to take the glass from his outstretched hand. Stack then dropped on one knee, and gently smoothed the calves of his legs, with an air of humble admiration. That I had but eyes. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he cried, to behold my captain's symmetrical proportions. That I had but eyes, to look upon these twin invaders of domestic peace. Apostrophe, apostrophe, get out. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Tappertit, glancing downward at his favorite limbs. Go along, will you, Stagg? Apostrophe, when I touch my own afterwards, apostrophe, cried the host, smiting them reproachfully, I hate 'em. Comparatively speaking, they've no more shape than wooden legs, beside these models of my noble captains. Apostrophe, yours. Apostrophe, apostrophe, exclaimed Mr. Tappertit. No, I should think not. Don't talk about those precious old toothpicks in the same breath with mine. That's rather too much. Here. Take the glass. Benjamin. Lead on. To business. Apostrophe, with these words, he folded his arms again, and frowning with a sullen majesty, passed with his companion through a little door at the upper end of the cellar, and disappeared, leaving Stagg to his private meditations. The vault they entered, strewn with sawdust and dimly lighted, was between the outer one from which they had just come, and that in which the skittle players were diverting themselves, as was manifested by the increased noise and clamor of tongues, which was suddenly stopped, however, and replaced by a dead silence, at a signal from the long comrade. Then, this young gentleman, going to a little cupboard, returned with a thigh bone, which in former times must have been part and parcel of some individual at least, as long as himself, and placed the same in the hands of Mr. Tappertit, who, receiving it as a scepter and staff of authority, cocked his three-cornered hat fiercely on the top of his head, and mounted a large table, whereon a chair of state, cheerfully ornamented with a couple of skulls, was placed ready for his reception. He had no sooner assumed this position, than another young gentleman appeared, bearing in his arms a huge clasped book, who made him a profound obeisance, and delivering it to the long comrade, advanced to the table, and turning his back upon it, stood there atlas-wise. Then, the long comrade got upon the table too, and seating himself in a lower chair than Mr. Tappertit's, with much state and ceremony, placed the large book on the shoulders of their mute companion as deliberately as if he had been a wooden desk, and prepared to make entries there with a pen of corresponding size. When the long comrade had made these preparations, he looked towards Mr. Tappertit, and Mr. Tappertit, flourishing the bone, knocked 9 times therewith upon one of the skulls. At the 9th stroke, a third young gentleman emerged from the door leading to the skittle ground, and bowing low, awaited his commands. "Prentice!" Apostrophe apostrophe said the mighty captain, "who waits without?" Apostrophe, the prentice made answer, that a stranger was in attendance, who claimed admission into that secret society of prentice knights, and a free participation in their rights, privileges, and immunities. Thereupon Mr. Tappertit flourished the bone again, and giving the other skull a prodigious rap on the nose, exclaimed, "Admit him." Apostrophe apostrophe at these dread words the prentice bowed once more, and so withdrew as he had come. There soon appeared at the same door, 2 other prentices, having between them a third, whose eyes were bandaged, and who was attired in a bag wig, and a broad-skirted coat, trimmed with tarnished lace, and who was girded with a sword, in compliance with the laws of the institution regulating the introduction of candidates, which required them to assume this courtly dress, and kept it constantly in lavender, for their convenience. One of the conductors of this novice held a rusty blunderbuss pointed towards his ear, and the other a very ancient saber, with which he carved imaginary offenders as he came along in a sanguinary and anatomical manner. As this silent group advanced, Mr. Tappertit fixed his hat upon his head. The novice then laid his hand upon his breast and bent before him. When he had humbled himself sufficiently, the captain ordered the bandage to be removed, and proceeded to eye him over. "Ha!" Apostrophe apostrophe said the captain, thoughtfully, when he had concluded this ordeal. "Proceed." Apostrophe, the long comrade read aloud as follows: "Mark Gilbert. Age, 19. Bound to Thomas Curzon, hosier, Golden Fleece, Aldgate. Loves Curzon's daughter. Cannot say that Curzon's daughter loves him. Should think it probable. Curzon pulled his ears last Tuesday week." Apostrophe, "How?" Apostrophe apostrophe cried the captain, starting. "For looking at his daughter, please you," apostrophe said the novice. "Write Curzon down, denounced," apostrophe said the captain. "Put a black cross against the name of Curzon." Apostrophe, "so please you," apostrophe said the novice, "that's not the worst. He calls his prentice idle dog, and stops his beer, unless he works to his liking. He gives Dutch cheese to, eating Cheshire, sir, himself, and Sundays out, are only once a month." Apostrophe, "this," apostrophe said Mr. Tappert semicolon T gravely, "is a flagrant case. Put 2 black crosses to the name of Curzon." Apostrophe, "if the society," apostrophe said the novice, who was an ill-looking, one-sided, shambling lad, with sunken eyes set close together in his head. If the society would burn his house down for he's not insured, or beat him as he comes home from his club at night, or help me to carry off his daughter, and marry her at the Fleet, whether she gave consent, or no apostrophe, Mr. Tappertit waved his grisly truncheon as an admonition to him not to interrupt, and ordered three black crosses to the name of Curzon. Which means, apostrophe he said in gracious explanation, vengeance, complete and terrible. Prentice, do you love the Constitution? Apostrophe, to which the novice, being to that end instructed by his attendant sponsors, replied I do. Apostrophe, apostrophe, the church, the state, and everything established but the masters? Apostrophe, apostrophe, quoth the captain. Again the novice said I do. Apostrophe, having said it, he listened meekly to the captain, who in an address prepared for such occasions, told him how that under that same constitution, which was kept in a strong box somewhere, but where exactly he could not find out, or he would have endeavored to procure a copy of it, the prentices had, in times gone by, at frequent holidays of right, broken people's heads by scores, defied their masters, nay, even achieved some glorious murders in the streets, which privileges had gradually been wrested from them, and in all which noble aspirations they were now restrained. How the degrading checks imposed upon them were unquestionably attributable to the innovating spirit of the times, and how they united therefore to resist all change, except such change as would restore those good old English customs, by which they would stand or fall. After illustrating the wisdom of going backward, by reference to that sagacious fish, the crab, and the not unfrequent practice of the mule and donkey, he described their general objects, which were briefly vengeance on their tyrant masters, of whose grievous and insupportable oppression no prentice could entertain a moment's doubt, and the restoration, as aforesaid, of their ancient rights and holidays. For neither of which objects were they now quite ripe, being barely 20 strong, but which they pledged themselves to pursue with fire and sword when needful. Then he described the oath which every member of that small remnant of a noble body took, and which was of a dreadful and impressive kind, binding him, at the bidding of his chief, to resist and obstruct the Lord Mayor, sword-bearer, and chaplain, to despise the authority of the sheriffs, and to hold the court of aldermen as Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.